I'm Linda Pelaccio, host of A Taste of the Past. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, and welcome to the Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here today with an extra special guest, Magnus Nilsson, all the way from, I'm going to mispronounce everything, so you're going to have to help me this.
No, that's fine.
From Faviken, which is just north of Stockholm.
6 hours just north of Stockholm.
Just north. It's like Canada for us here. You have a wonderful story behind you. Faviken is one of the, you know, top 25 restaurants in the world by Pellegrino. You yourself are, you know, a young man in chef standards, and to come to such acclaim from such a part of the world that up until about 5 years ago, I really believe wasn't explored and understood. What I have in front of me right now is a 700-plus page tome called The Nordic Cookbook by Faviken.
Very thick book.
Very thick. It's a workout, but it's a wonderful one.
Thank you.
And the amount of work and, you know, time that you put into traveling around Scandinavia or Nordic countries must have been mind-blowing for you as a person, too.
Yeah, very interesting.
Yeah.
Actually, been the best part of producing the book has been to do all these trips and to meet all the people who submitted recipes and, you know, just to experience a food culture that I thought I knew a lot about, but that it turned out I didn't know anything about.
Yeah. Well, I mean, as a little Swedish boy in the 80s, how far outside of Sweden did you actually get?
Well, maybe to Norway on vacation, on enforced vacation by my parents, perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, so was it culinary vacations? I mean,
no.
I think of Michelin Guide, and you think of, you know, France and Italy, and people do drive for that thing.
No, we don't do that. The thing with Nordic food culture that differs quite a bit from sort of Southern European food culture is that it's quite inaccessible, simply because it's mostly carried by people in their homes, not really by restaurants. So if you don't have, you know, someone that you know that can introduce you to it, it's quite difficult to experience as an outsider.
Yeah. I mean, as a young man, too, it wasn't your first thought to go into cookery school. I mean, you wanted to be a marine biologist.
I wanted to be so many things.
Yeah. I mean, you've already been so many things in your life. Who knows what's next?
Exactly.
But, you know, being a chef wasn't necessarily the profession of a lot of Scandinavians.
No, you know, as you said, I didn't plan on becoming that from the beginning either, but I always liked cooking, and food has always been important in the family as well. So,
I mean, is this a true story that you cooked your first meal at 3 years old?
Well, it's not a first-hand recollection.
Yeah.
No, my mom says that at least.
Yeah, chopping cucumbers at your grandmother's house. Mm. I mean, there was innateness around food. I mean, you felt something, some connection to it.
Definitely.
This move to France, which is most intriguing to me, not speaking the language, you knocked on the door of Alain Pressard at Arpège, worked there for a blip. And then
I actually started at Lastrance.
Oh, yeah? Yeah? With Pascal.
Yeah, and then I went to Arpège, and then I was fired from Arpège,
yeah.
And I went back to Lastrance again.
Yeah, but I mean, why France? Why not your home country for food?
I went there for vacation.
Yeah.
And I just happened to stay for almost 4 years.
Yeah, and what did you learn from Pascal Barbeau?
I think the most important thing, except learning a new language, which is, I think, the greatest thing with that that period of time, is perhaps, you know, to understand the difference between exceptionally good produce and just good produce.
Yeah.
Like, to widen your frame of reference.
Where it is, it's situated, I think, in Opera in Paris. You know, you have the President Wilson Market, great people, you know, growers down there. You have Rungis, which I know Pascal goes out to and is one of the few chefs to do so.
Yeah.
What were you open up to? What kind of product?
I think like the diversity and all that is not greater than in most other big cities. It's just that Pascal had, you know, the selection he makes of produce to the restaurant, to me then that was truly new, to just see not, you know, 10% of the produce being much better than everything else, but all of the produce being consistently very, very, very high quality.
I know one of the farmers, Joël Thibault, I think it's his name.
Yep.
You know, produced this book about vegetables and about all these chefs contributing recipes. But again, you know, the selection that Pascal had above anybody else, he'd walk to the market and Joël would see him and have a little stockpile of something special for him.
Exactly.
When you went back to, you know, Sweden, what did you take with you? I mean, did you actually take some produce and be like, this shit is awesome?
Well, the problem when I came back to Sweden was that the selection there wasn't, like, that selection wasn't available, you know, it was just wasn't there. And that made it very boring to cook.
Yeah. I mean, were you disenchanted? Did you not want to cook
definitely.
Anymore?
No, I stopped cooking.
Yeah. For how long?
More than a year. And I stopped, I planned to stop cooking completely and I started training to become a sommelier instead.
Yeah. So what is it about maybe becoming a wine writer that intrigued you more than being on the stove?
Well, it seemed like a good profession, you know?
Yeah.
Drinking wine, writing a little bit, all that stuff. You know?
So when this opportunity for Favakin, I mean, it was initially a wine position.
It was.
Who asked you and what drew you to that place?
A friend of mine who's also a chef, he helped out at Favakin from time to time with the family who owns it. And he asked me if I couldn't imagine just going up for 3 months to, you know, work with a wine cellar a little bit. And I thought that was, you know, just having finished my sommelier school, I thought that was a very good opportunity.
Yeah. So, I mean, talk to me about Favakin. The best thing I think anyone could do is go to the website, because there is this serene picture of snowy landscape and this temperature dial that says it's in the low 30s at the moment. It's snowy as hell. There's an amazing first scene in Chef's Table, which you were on, of you just scraping ice off the windshield of your car. I mean, does that? You're sitting in the dark corner of our studio. Are you used to that kind of a, you know, landscape?
Well, you know, I used to live in a city. I used to live in Paris for, as I said, for almost 4 years, and I like being in the city as well. But there's something special, you know, having grown up in the countryside like that, to be back and to, you know, be allowed to do the kind of restaurant that Favakin is in a location like that. It's pretty special.
Talk to me about Jämtland. I mean, how many acres of farmland do you have?
Oh, Favakin, I have no idea how many acres. So Favakin is about 10,000 hectares. Many acres.
Yeah, many acres.
And it's not all farmland. It's mostly forest and stuff like that. We have around Favakin, there are 40 hectares of farmland.
Yeah.
But it's a, you know, as opposed to what most people think, Jämtland is quite a rich agricultural region in the you know, the summers with all that light and quite stable temperatures and a lot of humidity, it produces very, very good growing conditions.
Yeah, I know. I think the assumption of you know, Scandinavian or Nordic cooking is more about the root cellar than it is about, you know, the bounty of produce that's there.
Yeah. I mean, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah. I mean, we're talking about the winter months right now. You know, it's starting to darken here. Preservation methods are, you know, very true to your heart. So how do you, as you say, defeat the seasons by kind of storing those things away and interjecting those into winter?
There are many ways of doing that, but I think the interesting thing with, you know, the focus on preserving things is that most people don't realize that loads of food that they eat every day are preserved. Also here, because like if you buy a carrot in January in New York, it's not going to be fresh from the ground, right? Someone will have picked it for you at the peak of its maturity and kept it under suitable conditions, you know, to be able to sell it for you later in the season. Everyone eats cheese and olives and ham and stuff like that. They're all different preservation techniques.
One of the most fascinating, I think, recipes in this Nordic cookbook is that of the preserved quail eggs. Rolled in ash. Tell me about that process and where in Iceland that exists.
So it's actually duck eggs. And it's in the sort of northeastern parts of Iceland. They do this thing when they harvest wild duck eggs in spring and they put it in big boxes. And these boxes are then filled with the ashes that are scraped out of the bottom of the traditional Icelandic smokehouse. And the ashes comes from burning sheep's shit, which is the fuel for those smokehouses.
Yeah.
And you know, obviously it's very alkaline, so it kind of cures the egg.
Yeah. You know, when you hear that out of context, people are like, sheep shit, alkaline. What does this all mean? But, I mean, there's alkalinity in pretzels. I mean, lye.
Yeah, but imagine a 1,000-year-old egg in Asia.
Yeah.
It's the same basic idea. And obviously these things are, you know, extreme. Even within the region, it's very, like, that's not what I have on my breakfast sandwich.
Yeah.
But I thought it was very important to include them in the book regardless, because without them, like, the story is not complete. Mm-hmm. You can't take away those things just because they're inaccessible.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually made a little count last week, and there are 730-something recipes in the book. And I think that 50 of them or so, no one is going to cook. because they contain something like that, you know, a product that's impossible to obtain.
What do you think are the furthest reaches? What do you think are the recipes that, you know, I want to challenge people to do these?
I think that that's one of them.
Yeah.
And there are, you know, other recipes containing like birds that you can't get, like puffin and stuff like that. But I think the interesting thing with this book, because this is really a snapshot of like everyday food culture in the Nordic region. So the remaining 670-something recipes, they're actually stuff that people eat on an everyday basis in many homes in the Nordics,
mm-hmm.
meaning that they're accessible also for people here. And to me, that's very important.
I mean, again, you mentioned puffins. There are reindeer, which we don't have much of here. They are very similar. I mean, you kind of put them in sections where it's poultry and meat and game. Yeah. I mean, we have poultry, meat and game. So it is a relatable cuisine.
Yeah, and you shouldn't focus on those products because there are so few of the recipes in the book that actually contain them. Most of the recipes contain beef and pork and chicken and cod and, you know, produce that's available everywhere. But it's so easy when you leaf through a book with, information about the culture with which you're not very knowledgeable already, to focus on the extremes. And the extremes, they might be there more to tell a story and to explain a context than anything else.
I'm not going to mention IKEA, because I think that's a lot of people's kind of entryway into Scandinavian cooking. You know, yeah, meatballs, sauerbrot, open-faced sandwiches.
Which is probably not all that bad, but it is what it is. It's, highly industrial, yeah. Enormous quantity, very, very cheap, and then you get what you get.
There's a lot of Jewish appetizing in New York. So, I mean, we have gravlax, we have herring,
yeah.
And I think it's more related to that Ashkenazi sect rather than Scandinavian, and you know, it shares similarities. So it's been here in New York for a long time, the quality ingredients to be able to construct these things. Yep. Being in New York right now, are you going to supermarkets? Are you going to markets and seeing the necessary ingredients to be able to reconstruct some of these recipes?
Not this time, because it's a very tight schedule with the whole book coming out.
Yeah.
And all that. But the thing is that, like, if you look at most parts of the northern hemisphere, at least the west, you know, the western countries, produce is kind of similar. You know, obviously there are regional differences, but what we have to cook from on an everyday basis back home in Sweden is not all that different sort of from what you'll find here. People tend to over-exaggerate the differences a little bit.
Yeah, well, we're going to come back and talk about some of those lesser-known recipes, rose hip soup, pork roasted with prunes, juniper beer, and so much more. We'll be right back. Hey, and welcome back to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Again, with Magnus Nilsson and this gimungous book, The Nordic Cookbook, now out by Fiden. I mean, I want to talk about recipes. There are so many. And, you know, usually I try to read a book cover to cover before I have a guest in. this is one that you kind of have to dwell on and, you know, yeah. Pick and choose. But, you know, some of the highlights for me are the kind of Christmas time things that are happening in this. And one of my favorite things is Janssen's temptation.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about, you know, how a simple potato dish is that much more?
So the Janssen temptation is one of those really classic Swedish dishes. And like when you eat it, it's either as part of a smorgasbord or as a late night snack, you know, having been out or having had a party and then throwing out some Janssen and some aquavit and a few beers.
Yeah.
Like 4 o'clock in the morning. And basically what it is that it's coarsely grated potatoes, a bit of onion, and then cured sprats. And they're cured with sandalwood and salt and sugar. So they're, you know, very savory and quite perfumed. And then you just sort of mix that in a casserole and you add cream and breadcrumbs and you just, you know, cook that in the oven.
Yeah. I mean, was it some guy named Janssen that was just tempted by this casserole someday, you know, like a pie on a windowsill?
It's actually, no, it's actually, you know, rumor has it that he was a musician, opera singer. And rumor has it that he, you know, treated guests to this at his sort of after his late night adventures in Stockholm.
Yeah.
There's actually several Swedish dishes that, you know, bears his name.
Yeah. Another wonderful potato dish that's actually found its way, I think, into American culture a lot is Hasselbacken or Hasselback potatoes.
Yeah.
Did you ever grow up eating Hasselback potatoes?
Yeah. That's like classic Swedish grandma cooking.
Yeah. And it's so smart because of how it's fanned out and cooked. Everything's so evenly and crisp and delicious. Yeah.
It was invented on a cooking school in Stockholm called Hasselbacken, like early 20th century.
Yeah. Again, you know, you said a lot of these recipes aren't from restaurants, aren't, you know, easily accessible by...
None of them are from restaurants.
So when you go into somebody's home, what's the first thing you ask of them? Like, cook me your favorite dish, or what do you have in your pantry?
Well, the thing is that if you, like, what has been very fascinating with producing this book is that I often travel to places with a plan to photograph or to document something specific, and then I try to leave quite a bit of time unscheduled. And it's quite fascinating if you're traveling on your own and you're open to it, how much people want to show you about your food culture.
Yeah.
And you get invited to people's homes to stay there and to cook for you, and you know, it all comes very naturally if you're curious to do things.
So going to the Faroe Islands, were you in search of a whale hunt and you kind of use that as your way in?
I was not, because I knew that it was such a rare thing to get to see. And I've been to the Faroe Islands quite a few times, and I have actually also seen a whale hunt myself, which was a very particular experience. But that's something that you can't plan, it just happens. And I've always gone there for, you know, other reasons to perhaps record other more common occurrences, like, you know, the cured mutton meat and things like that.
Well, I think one of those food dares that happen is the fermented, you know, whale fat, that whale blubber or meat. Is it really a delicacy in that area of the world, or is it...
They don't really ferment their whale blubber there. What they do is that either they just salt it and they eat it much like we eat, you know, like lardo or something like that.
Yeah.
Or it's boiled.
So I guess I'm thinking more of, you know, rotten shark.
Yeah, that's a different thing. That's Iceland.
So, I mean, like, you know, they're in Iceland, and then you have sour herring, the surströmming, you know, which is also one of those things. Well, talk to me about the experience of opening up surströmming, you know, from a can the first time.
Well, I grew up eating surströmming, so that's not, to me, that's not very particular. But, but I can still recognize its exceptionally strong flavor or and aroma. And I think that... One thing that's really important when producing a book like this about someone else's food culture or, you know, other people's recipes, because this book is not about my ideas about things, it's about documenting food culture, is to remove yourself and your opinions from the recipe content. So there are plenty of recipes in that book that I'm not necessarily familiar to from before, and there are plenty of recipes in that book that I wouldn't necessarily want to cook on an everyday basis either, but they're still important because some people in the Nordic region do cook them every day, and they're important for them.
What were the most unfamiliar things to me, or maybe even the hardest things for you to kind of that were the hardest, most least palatable?
I don't know, and it doesn't really. I think that's kind of besides the point as well, because you know, the book is not about my opinions.
Yeah. Another place that you traveled, the thermal active areas south of, you know, this lake in Iceland where all these rye breads are kind of cooked outdoors. I mean, this is how they bake bread. Is this something that you grew up with, or does it feel like a spectacle?
No, I didn't grow up like that because we don't have any volcanoes in Sweden. But the thing with bread is that it's one of the few dishes, or I shouldn't say dishes, but one of the few sort of food cultural occurrences that you'll find in the whole Nordic region. And how it's made and how it's consumed, it says quite a lot about where it's produced. And you can look at Iceland as an example. You know, you have these sort of very dense rye breads, and Iceland is a country without trees, pretty much, so very, very little firewood. And oven-baked loaves of bread weren't popularized there until the introduction of the cast iron stove. And they were fired with peat, and they were made mostly to cook on and to heat your home, not really for baking. So they developed this culture of, as you said, using the thermally active areas for baking. And a lot of villages have like a communal area close to some hot springs with holes dug in the ground. Every family have their own hole. And in the evening, you'll go there with a bucket of rye bread, though, put it in your hole, and then come back in the morning and have a freshly steamed loaf, which is quite fantastic. And then, like where I grew up, you know, the most common bread would probably be a flatbread, a barley-based flatbread. If you go to southern Scandinavia, to, let's say, from Stockholm and southwards and all through Denmark, people will probably have loaves, because that's the only densely populated areas in Scandinavia or in the Nordics. So that's really historically where you had bakeries. And, you know, bakeries are essential to have loaves, because loaves have to be eaten on, you know, pretty much the same day that they were baked, or at least, you know, within a couple of days. So it really says quite a lot about where you, you know, if you look at the bread, you can tell a lot about people.
Yeah. I mean, I think that way about fika too, you know, the coffee break that happens in Sweden. Did you see that kind of culture happen throughout the other Nordic countries as well?
Well, the thing with food culture, you know, is that so all cultural expressions, they happen because they make sense to someone right there and then. And food culture is interesting because not only is it the only cultural expression that everyone have to relate to, simply because we all eat, it's also one that's very immediate, and it changes very, very quickly. And I think that's, you know, how food is consumed and how we eat and how we communicate about food, it says like a lot about who we are and where we are living in the world.
I mean, let's talk about the iterations of meatballs. I was lucky enough to live here in New York when Nordic Delicacies, this great little deli out in Bay Ridge, was open. When I first moved here, they still had Joika, you know, reindeer meatballs, like pseudo-legally. No, again, IKEA, the Sweden sour meatballs, Swedish meatballs, and I'm air quoting that. How many different meatballs have you seen around the Nordic countries, and how do they differ from one another?
Loads, and it's kind of for the same reasons, you know, but people don't make things in the long run which doesn't make sense to them. And with meatballs, you know, like the technique of grinding meat and then, you know, rolling it into a ball and frying it or boiling it or otherwise cooking it, that's something you can find all across the world. And how it's made and what it's made from, though, is something that really differs from place to place. And you'll see, like in Denmark, a lot of pig production, for example, a lot of pig farms, you'll have a pretty good chance of finding meatballs with only pig or with veal in them. Sweden, a lot of dairy production, you know, giving a lot of beef. Most meatballs will be a mix of beef and pork. Where I grew up, there's a lot of moose hunting, so the meatballs will be based on moose and pork.
Cabbage, also kind of, you know, synonymous with a lot of Scandinavian cuisine, that you know, pickle, that slightly sweet and sour. You know, I saw a couple of those Finnish soups, one kind of standard, one creamy. I mean, how many different iterations of cabbage did you see?
I have no idea.
Yeah, it was kind of a ridiculous chapter. So large and so wide, but also similar. I mean, again, you see kind of this base and everything, and it kind of expands out in whatever country it's in. One other example of that was pike, which I know more so kind of, you know, like Lyonnaise, you know, French.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, as a quenelle, and you have it with, you know, some kind of sauce mousseline. How did you see fish expressed throughout all these countries? I know you went to Norway to an amazing fishing village.
Yeah, but, you know, it's the same thing there, that people eat what makes sense to them right there and then where they're living. And, you know, in the Baltic areas of the Nordics, for example, like Sweden and Finland, you'll have one kind of fish culture. And then moving across to the Norwegian coastline, for example, you have completely different species of fish and, you know, a completely different climate, and therefore also, you know, very different way of consuming the fish.
I mean, what do you hope to be the biggest export of this book? What idea, what product?
Oh, that's also very difficult. But I think that, like, for me, the purpose is basically to describe food culture as it is today and where it came from. And not only supply, you know, a big collection of recipes, but also a context so that people actually understand why they make sense and, you know, how they became there and stuff like that.
How does grouse, mushrooms, and tasty paste draw from these recipes?
So running a restaurant like Fäviken, it's always going to be a reflection of the person behind it. And naturally, for me, you know, being Swedish, growing up in the Nordic region, growing up in the countryside, having a special interest for these sort of traditional cooking techniques and the everyday food culture of people, that's sort of naturally going to reflect into all the cooking value.
It's not even so much about, you know, these dishes, but the ingredients that are in them. Mm. You know, you have blood bread, you have moose broth, you have bog butter, you know, you have lichen, spruce scenting the ice cream. If you were to describe the palate of your food, I know you have a multi-course tasting thing. What is it? Is it more towards bitter? Is it more towards herbaceous?
I usually don't do that because I think that it comes, like, going to a restaurant that's, you know, very expensive, like Fäviken is, and for most people also takes a great effort. I think part of what you pay for is to be allowed to describe your own, you know, food experience. So I never talk about how people are going to possibly perceive what we do because I don't think that's sort of my job. My job is to produce what we do and make people enjoy it rather than telling them how to enjoy it and, you know, that you're going to enjoy it.
Well, I feel like people will enjoy it even more if they go to Denmark, Faroe Islands, Finland, Greenland, Iceland, Norway, and Sweden. So they have that context to be able to walk into Fäviken and explore those.
But that we supply them with, because you can't even hope for everyone to do that.
Yeah.
Most people living in the Nordics don't do that either. But we will see, like, for me, it's really important for each dish to supply enough of a context so that people can understand why it makes sense. And then I leave it up to them to enjoy it and or to not enjoy it if, you know, that's what happens.
Well, if you can't get yourself to Fäviken, which you really should, hopefully there's enough context in this wonderful book, The Nordic Cookbook by Fäviken. Thank you so much, Magnus, for being on The Food Scene.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks again for listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org, and we hope to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. Cheers.
Listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.